Shrink Wrap Radio number 630, The Conditions That Create Transformational Therapy Sessions with Dr. Paul J. Leslie.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today's episode is sponsored by Blinkist.com, providing the key takeaways from the world's best nonfiction books. My guest today, Paul J. Leslie, is a therapist and author in Aiken, South Carolina. He's authored 5 books, including Potential, Not Pathology, Helping Your Clients Transform Using Ericksonian Psychotherapy, and The Art of Creating a Magical Session, Key Elements for Transformative Psychotherapy. For more information about Dr. Paul J. Leslie, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Paul J. Leslie, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dave. It is an honor, pleasure to be with you. I've enjoyed listening to you for a while, so it's good to kind of meet.
Oh, well, that's good. I didn't know that you were a listener. Yeah. So, yeah, that's wonderful. I always love it when I get a chance to talk to listeners. Mm-hmm. And actually, because I didn't know you were a listener and didn't know your work, unfortunately, thankfully, our mutual friend, the Australian therapist Richard Hill, contacted me and said, hey, you got to talk to this guy.
Right, yeah.
And so I said, well, any friend of yours is a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we got here. Yeah. And I'm aware that the three of us have in common an interest in psychotherapy that's been, I would say, hypnotically influenced somehow. Yeah. And particularly the unconventional work of Milton Erickson, of which all three of us have been fans for some time.
Right.
Yeah, and it turns out that you've also written a book about Milton Erickson, and you've got information in there that I knew it some time back, but in the introduction to it, you refer to his bout of polio. And let me give the name of the book, by the way, before we go into that. It was written in 2014, mm-hmm. and the title is Potential, Not Pathology, and I resonate to that title. The subtitle is Helping Your Clients Transform Using Ericksonian Psychotherapy.
Right.
So yeah. I didn't know that Erickson as a child suffered from polio. Maybe we could take it up there too, because I'd love to have you kind of set the stage for us about who Milton Erickson was and how you got drawn into his way of thinking.
Right. Certainly. Erickson, for most of his childhood, he didn't have polio, but in his later teenage years, I think he was stricken then. So he was a very athletic and active young man on the farm way back when. And then, unfortunately, polio got him. And as a matter of fact, interesting side stories that the doctors one evening pretty much told his parents that he would not live through the night. Yeah. And Erickson overheard this from the other room. And I think he heard, at least from what I read, he heard his mother obviously being distraught by that news. And he got so angry, according to him, with the doctors that he was hell-bent and determined, I'm going to live through the night. Now, whatever happens after that, but I'm just going to show them that you don't give up on people and you don't, you know, hurt my mom's feelings, you know.
Yeah.
And certainly he lived through the night, but for a while he was mostly paralyzed. And what led to this amazing exploration of hypnotic therapy and psychotherapy is while he was paralyzed, unlike a lot of people where we, you know, woe is me and, you know, this is the way it is. And he started to learn about how the mind affects the body. So he would just for hours envision his hands being able to move. And then in time, he'd see his hands move a little bit or his legs move and being able to move his body closer to a window. And he would play it over and over in his mind and almost convince himself that he was doing it. And as we know with the brain now, those components of intense visualization can often be registered as real events. So he was teaching his body how to work again. And eventually he recovered enough where he had a bad limp, but he was able to walk for a while with a cane. So even though back then, you know, even having a cane as a young man, you were kind of slightly ostracized because you were defective. He was in a much better place than he was. And I think he used that interest in the way the mind can affect the body and the body can affect the mind that really filtered the way he looked at psychology when he went off to college to study it.
Yeah, and he ended up becoming a psychiatrist, right?
That's correct.
And a very unconventional psychiatrist, and somehow that experience that you relate of discovering that he could adapt his unique mental capacities to mm-hmm. kind of heal himself kind right. of sets the stage for the rest of his career, really, as a unconventional psychiatrist. Nobody else was like him.
Right. And I think so much of his personality was I don't know, because I never got to meet, unfortunately, Dr. Erickson, but a lot of people would say, you know, he was just a little weird or maybe higher on the spectrum. But he really did see the world in a totally unique way. I remember his father one day was trying to pull a mule into the barn. And, you know, mules are not going if they're not going to go, and just pulling. And so Erickson, as a young boy, realized that fighting against the resistance, and we'll put this in the therapy frame, wasn't working. So he went over when his father had released a little bit of the pull and grabbed the mule's tail and yanked it. And then the mule jumped forward and went right into where it needed to go. And just so he was already, as a young boy, saw the world a different way. And that did color the fact that, you know, everyone's looking at a problem focus. It allowed his mind to go into other areas, to utilize resources that, you know, at the time, nobody was working that way. And as a matter of fact, some of his colleagues even thought that Erickson had a psychotic break in the same way that his clients had, because he was so radically different. You know, there was no excessive orientation of what was wrong. There was a focus on freeing up the person, having more flexibility. So the whole, and at that time period when he was coming up, you know, psychoanalysis was, you know, the big thing. And there's some value to that. I don't put down any specific theory or technique. But Erickson was just, he saw that if you were going to go to the past for a search for etiology, it only needed to happen if it would help move the person forward. And most of his therapy interventions were either present or future-oriented rather than past. And that was, you know, something we more so now, but back then that was just totally unheard of.
Yeah. So we should let people know that he's been dead for a number of years now, but there are lots of books that have been written about his work, including now yours, and lots of people have been so impressed by the stories of he wrote about a lot of the therapy that he did, I guess, and people collected his papers and put together some volumes, and the title of the other book that you've written that we're going to be talking about talks about magical interventions, and reading those stories, they just seem so magical,
right?
And and I think a lot of us have tried to be Milton Erickson in one way or another, and of course that doesn't work. We can't.
Exactly.
We're
exactly.
not him. We don't have the same life experience and everything. So let's get a bit into the book that you wrote, in which you pull out some three major strategies that seem to run through his work. And that's a real service, because his work is just, there are all these stories and they're all over the place, and to try to figure out, to try to begin to figure out how can I master this? Yeah. It helps to have a bit of a roadmap. And so I think you give us some real help in that area. And so the first one is utilization. That was a term that he used. And tell us about utilization. Maybe you can give us an example or two from your own work.
Sure. And to me, utilization, if every therapist opened up a little bit to allow space for utilization, I think the outcomes for most therapists would be so different, regardless of the therapeutic orientation. So what utilization is essentially using whatever is given to us as a way to help clients meet their goals, even if it's resistance. Erickson was not someone who dealt a lot with resistance. It's kind of, I call it the water therapy, because water goes downhill, and when it meets a rock, it goes around the rock. It doesn't just pile up and keep hitting the rock. You know, waterfall does, but that's fresh water. You know, it'll go on around its path. And so what Erickson did is, no matter what the client gave him, good or bad, or, you know, he kind of released all judgments of that, he would use it as a way to move clients closer to their goal, or to help heal. The most famous, or one of the most famous examples of Erickson's work was, there was a young man who was in the mental hospital, which Erickson was the medical director. The man was very certain that he was Jesus Christ, the original Jesus Christ. Wow. And so apparently he was sitting in, he had taken the sheets, you know, and then on the bed and torn it and put it over his neck, and, you know, I guess was being magnanimous when he wasn't having psychotic breaks. But he was convinced he was Jesus Christ. And, you know, rather than try to convince the man he wasn't, Erickson felt that what he needed was to get out of this isolated existence he was as Jesus, and to interact more with people. So Erickson went into his room one day, and he said, "They tell me that you're a carpenter." And the young man smiled and said, "Yes." And he says, "I need your help. I have a group that's learning carpentry, and I would really appreciate your skill, your knowledge, because, you know, I'm not a carpenter." And in time, making a long story short, this man, who eventually started interacting more as almost a co-teacher in the carpentry group they were doing, started to kind of come back to reality, whatever that is, but a shared reality, that fighting against it and trying to make him do this or do that was going nowhere. So Erickson just used whatever as a way to move him into a different place. I'll give you one of mine real quick.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The only reason I bring this up, my father loves this story for some reason. I don't know why. He read it in the book, and just he loves to tell everybody this story. I had a family come in who had a six-year-old boy who believed he was a dog. And, you know, kids play and, you know, do all those kind of things. But this had gone on for months and months and months, to where there was no time that the child wasn't a dog. He would get on the floor and bark. He wouldn't answer to his name. He would just act like a dog. He'd go to school, disrupt things being a dog. His parents had tried punishing him, had tried doing all these kind of things. They were good parents, but they were just, we don't know what to do. They were about to get to the point of basically putting the kid on medication. But then someone said, "Well, before you do that, there's this weird guy in town named Paul Leslie. Go see him. And if he can't help you, that's fine." So they came into my office, and they told me the story about the kid's a dog. The boy was a dog. So rather than fight against the boy being a dog, I asked the parents. I said, "What do dogs eat?" And they said, "Dog food." I said, "What do boys eat?" And they said, "People food." "Is this dog," pointing to the boy, "is this dog eating people food?" And they said, "Yes." And, "Where do dogs sleep?" They said, "Outside." "Where do boys sleep?" They said, in the bed. I said, are you letting the dog in the bed? And I'm like, yeah. And then they started to get it. Yeah. And so that night when they got home, they put out the stop and got some dog food and a bowl of water. And that was his dinner. And then when it was time to go to bed, the dog had to go out on the back porch where it was a little cool and dark, even though they were looking through the blind, you know, at him the whole time. And with about an hour, there was a knock at the door. And it was the boy. And, of course, the dad had to play it up. Well, we don't have a boy. We have a dog. Dogs can't talk. Who is this? You know? And he started acting like a little boy again. I have no idea why for months he was acting that way. But I knew that if I continued to fight against that, as they had valiantly, I would lose. And that is another example for me of using what the boy was giving me.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
To help him.
Yeah, that's a great example. Now, another strategy that you highlight of Erickson's was changing patterns.
Yeah. I've always kind of viewed, and Dr. Erickson had this view, which gave me courage to kind of explore this on my own too, that the root of most of our problems is how inflexible we are. We are practitioners of habit, or we get into habits of assuming how things will be in our lives. And then when things change, sometimes we try to put old patterns to new situations that don't work, and we continue to try and do that. Or due to certain experiences, we get into ways of interacting that become very rigid. And again, it's instead of fighting against a pattern, by altering a pattern, interrupting patterns in a way. And let me just say, always respectful to the client.
Yeah.
You know, it's so crucial that we have the client's permission, that we have that great therapeutic alliance, that we see them as a human being rather than something to tinker with. For example, if someone has a couple has a pattern of arguing, and it seems to be a nightly knockdown, drag out pattern. Well, find out where they argue. I had a couple one time, they always argued downstairs. You know, I had to get all the details, and it's always after dinner. So I would ask them to not stop arguing, because I knew they weren't going to do that anyway.
Yeah.
But then to go upstairs and argue, and then go into the bathroom. And before they can really get into their argument, the husband would have to take off his clothes and lie in the tub. And the wife would have to take off her shoes and sit on the toilet with her fully clothed. And they could only argue from there. But they had full permission to argue.
Yeah.
But that's changing a setting. It's changing a pattern. I had a lady who one time had an OCD where she had to knock 7 times. Anytime she got a thought about health issues and you know, kind of overwhelming that she'd get sick and die. So having her knock 7 times was not something that I could take away. So I just asked her between every knock to do like a jumping jack, put an arm straight in the air or something.
Yeah.
Between every knock. And then within a week or two, 7 knocks became 4 knocks, which eventually became 2 knocks. So we all are interacting, and we're doing patterns, and we do it all the time without thinking about it. I've in my other book, which we'll talk about, I talk about breaking a spell, how we are in a spell of patterns and sometimes dysfunctional patterns. And breaking a spell to me is merely when we alter the habitual response, we suddenly free up creative energy that then allows us to go in multiple directions. So when we say somebody's under a spell, it's usually our own spell. And by altering these patterns, we can get new behaviors without excessive investigation of you know, where the patterns come from. Because sometimes people don't even know, to be fair. They just don't know. And instead of digging and digging, by respectfully, doing that and altering it. And I think people just in general, like if you always get up and take a shower and then brush your teeth, then take a shower. If you get out of the left side, get out of the right side of the brush. Always do different things to kind of, you know, free up a little bit of your own creativity.
Yeah, I want to underscore something that you've reiterated a couple of times, which is to do this stuff, you've got to build on the relationship. You have to have a relationship,
right?
Rather than just spring this out of the box right away, because it's they're willing to try some of these things because of that alliance that you've built with them. Yes. And what I'm realizing as you're talking about the patterns is I'm an older guy now, and so I'm experiencing some older guy phenomena that I did not experience as a younger guy, where the absent-minded professor, I guess. It's not that I'm absent. It's that it's harder to multitask now. Right. And if I'm doing something, one of those patterns will get triggered. And so both my wife and I are experiencing this of, why did I go downstairs? Uh-huh. I was just upstairs. I don't even know why I came downstairs. Why am I, I'm going to pour my coffee in my cup, but instead I'm pouring it into my cereal. Well, uh-huh. some pattern got launched. The pouring of liquid pattern Uh-huh. got launched and then went off on its own somewhere, went off the track. Yeah. So, and this is happening with all of us at any age. It's just when we're younger, those patterns are getting rehearsed and set and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed over a lifetime. So the later, when you get older like I am, they're there and they can get triggered in weird ways.
Right. Yeah. You know, one thing I learned from my ex-wife, who was a massage therapist, is that people's bodies, they hold patterns of how far they think they can go. She would have someone who'd had shoulder surgery a year earlier and didn't think that their shoulder could go more than a certain number of degrees. But then she would distract them and work on something else and then covertly move their arm further than they thought it could go, and then say, look at your arm. And when they looked over at it, they went, wow. And from that point on, their arm could go even further. So we do the same kind of thing with, I think, our mental. We don't really realize how far we can go. And it takes someone outside of our frame of reference to come in and go, hey, you can go a little farther than you thought. And then it becomes your reality. Your spell has been slightly broken or maybe full broken. And then I can do more things.
Yeah. Sometimes people talk about, when they're talking about hypnosis and they're trying to persuade people that, yes, you go into a trance, and they'll mention what's called highway hypnosis, right? Uh-huh. And, you know, where you go past your exit because you're still driving in your car, but you just, you know, and then maybe you see something. Mm-hmm. That breaks that trance. So, wait a second, that's the Bank of America. That's way past where I need to go.
Exactly. So, or you show up, you do arrive, you pull in the parking lot, and you go, where's the trip? I mean, I don't remember 15 minutes of this trip.
You know? Yeah, that's true. And that's scary when you realize that. You say, oh my God, what?
Yeah.
Seems like anything could happen. The third Ericksonian strategy that you pull out is multi-level communication. Tell us about that.
Well, Erickson had this unique ability that he might not have been the first one to discover it, but he was certainly someone who was able to use it in a psychotherapeutic manner and on some level pass it on. And what this means is that the premise is we have two minds, our conscious mind, which is aware, and then our unconscious. And our unconscious mind is that part of ourself that, you know, beats our heart, breathes, thinks about other things, you know, as we're driving the car, as our conscious mind is thinking about, you know, picking up milk at the grocery store. And that was a model in which he kind of utilized in talking to people. So when he would talk to people, sometimes he'd tell them stories, which were covert metaphors for solving their problem, for them to solve their problem. Or he would do what we call the interspersal technique, in which he would just in telling his story, he would pause at certain places and speak in a certain way that a phrase or two would get taken in more easily by the unconscious mind, because the conscious mind's listening to the story.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, it's tied up. So it's not going to resist things. Again, this is Erickson's thing. You go around resistance. So as an example, if you want someone to relax more deeply, instead of going, you need to relax more deeply, try to relax more deeply. I don't know why you're not going to relax more deeply. You know, he would just tell a story about a friend of his that was had this unique ability.
Yeah.
To really just let go.
Yeah.
And become comfortable. And it's almost as if that person could relax more deeply than he thought. And so that's little spacing and that story. And it's about somebody else. It's, you know, my shields aren't going up saying, you know, you're not going to hypnotize me or even tell me new information. But it gets in there. And he was able to change his state at a way to create that change in the other person's state and co-create this hypnotic experience. So he could tell in stories and metaphors and those kind of things how to give people access to resources mentally and emotionally that would maybe move them closer to obtaining the goal that they wanted.
Yeah, and you're reminding me that he would use a confusion technique to kind of jam the person's circuits in a way.
Yeah.
They'd be so distracted trying to figure out, what is this guy doing that their conscious mind is totally occupied with that, mm-hmm. while he's able to slip in some, indirectly, some suggestions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't meet him either, and it's one of the great regrets. I didn't know that you could.
Yeah.
I later learned that during the period in which I was either in graduate school or already had a PhD, there were people going down there in Arizona where he was and studying with him and so on. I didn't even know that was on the map. That was a possibility. I read some of these books and all. So I regret that. Let's move on to your second book, speaking of books. Mm-hmm. And it's got a lovely title, The Art of Creating a Magical Session, Key Elements for Transformative Psychotherapy. And I love that, both the main title and the subtitle, that in the subtitle you clearly announce that you're looking for transformative therapy.
Right.
Which
right.
says to me, this is not just getting rid of a symptom, this is not just tweaking something, mm-hmm. but what I'm looking for here is a big life-changing shift.
Right.
And what you refer to as a magical session. Before I have you go into magical sessions, Paul, I need to cut in here to acknowledge the sponsor for today's episode, Blinkist.com. It's a website and an app that allows you to absorb the big ideas of a book in about 15 minutes. We're all so short on time these days. So the idea is that in about 15 minutes, you can get all the key ideas from a nonfiction book that you're interested in. Perhaps you're like me and enjoy listening to audiobooks. Well, Blinkist selections can be either read with your eyeballs or listened to with your ears, which means you can even read, so to speak, when you're driving a car. Blinkist editors comb the bestseller list for the most intriguing nonfiction reads out there. They read the books themselves and pull out the most important insights, which they call blinks. They carefully craft a structure of blinks to bring the key ideas to light. The selection of books is quite large, covering a wide range of nonfiction categories, ranging from such topics as mindfulness, leadership, psychology, self-help, business, and more. For example, just yesterday, my wife had to go to the doctor, and I was in the waiting room with nothing to do. So I whipped out my iPhone, pulled up the Blinkist app, and decided I wanted to read something outside the field of psychology. So I chose the book Seven Brief Lessons on Physics by Carlo Rovelli. In 15 minutes, I learned relativity theory and quantum theory pretty much explain everything about the physical universe, from the smallest subatomic particles to galaxies. The big takeaway for me, though, is that these two very important theories, relativity and quantum, are incompatible. They contradict each other. The scientists who are trying to resolve this paradox are working in a field called quantum gravity. Who knew? Thank you, Blinkist.com. Right now, for a limited amount of time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our Shrink Wrap Radio listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/shrink to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/shrink to start your free 7-day trial. Once more, that's Blinkist.com/shrink. So with that, let's go back to our discussion about making therapy miraculous. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we probably should ask you, what do you mean by a magical session?
Well, I kind of look at the term magical, and I looked up in the dictionary, and one of the definitions is removed from everyday life or everyday experience, an enchanted way of being. And for me, that's a goal of mine, is that when people are in therapy with us, they're looking for an experience. I mean, granted, they want information, but a lot of times they already know the information. They already know the things that they need to do. It's just sometimes it's harder to implement it. So if we have some kind of experience in the therapy room where not only the goals are met, and I call that effective therapy. When goals are met, that's effective. And I think it's important to have clear goals and check with those goals and make sure that it's the goals that the client wants and not the therapist. So you co-create the goals, but then there's this above, if we use a term meta or whatever, bigger frame is transformation. So this, and it's hard to put into words because it's almost in this embodied sense that something is radically different in the way I perceive myself and my situation, more than just, oh, I realize my irrational thought patterns are what's kind of causing my anxiety. I mean, that's good. But where there's a big shift into where the person sees themselves, sees the world, and has the feeling that they are radically different. Something's different. A lot of times they can't put, even the therapist can't put the words on. This is not a technique because, again, the research, if anyone pays attention to a lot of the research over the last 20 years of the common factor, shows that when you strip everything down, theories and techniques end up equally working about the same. It's the therapeutic alliance that's the most important. So building on that, we got to really know our techniques and theories, but there's this added dimension of creating a magical experience for the person, doing our therapy, our techniques, but how we're doing them, in what context, and opening ourselves up to things where we're not following rigid protocols or standardized treatments, but yet we still are grounded in our skill. Unfortunately, I think, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, I am seeing way too much regimentation and too much structure in therapy sessions. And as one of my colleagues, who's a well-known therapist, I won't name, said, you know, Paul, most sessions you watch on these videos today are just boring. And I think that's true. They are boring. Sometimes, okay, you got to be a little boring, but there's got to be some dynamic happening. And I think that if we can find out what those elements are, that we can kind of, how do I put this? We can set the conditions for magic to come into the session.
It kind of goes back to the highway hypnosis thing.
Yeah.
As therapists, we're in a kind of highway hypnosis, if you will, of being locked into patterns.
Right, yeah.
And you're challenging us in your thinking and in your work. You're challenging us to challenge ourselves
right.
to break out of that and tap into our own creativity.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the big thing a lot we're missing is creativity. You can be the greatest cognitive behavioral therapist, gestalt therapist, you know, we got, 500 different types of
Somewhere in there. That. Now, yeah.
List them all. You can be great at that. But if you aren't creative at really interacting with the person that's in front of you in the moment, and you're not looking at them as a unique individual, which what they're going to give you something, and you have to roll with what they're giving you, and you need them to respond a certain way. It kind of reminds me, as I'm talking about this, just popped in my head. Years and years ago, when I was a young man, I tried to take a certain karate martial art. And they said, when the attacker does this, then you do that. And it seemed logical. And I would practice, you know. And in training, it always worked. Because when the person, I knew they were going to do this, and then I do that. And then, you know, you finally put on the gloves and get out. And then, you know, get hit in the nose. And you're going like, what happened? And the thing is, the training partner, when you're sparring, didn't do what you thought they were going to do. That's the whole point of it. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, a lot of how therapy is taught, in my opinion, this is my opinion alone, but I don't think I'm alone.
I was going to say, not alone.
I just think it's that they're so stuck on do this at this time and use this theory and use this technique. And I'm not saying it can't be effective. But we're missing, we could be more if we're alive and dynamic and see that this, we have a unique individual in front of us. I mean, the big thing now, you get the CUs, trauma therapy. Okay, well, where's the individual in trauma? Trauma therapy, that's great. Are we doing therapy with an individual or are we doing it with the trauma? You know, little distinctions on language. Where's the individual? It's like when they asked Salvador Mnuchin about systemic therapy toward the end of his life. He said, where's the family in systemic family therapy? Because it's all become techniques and narratives, and there's not the family. Where's the family in this?
And yeah, I think it's reminding me of Carl Jung supposedly said, thank God I'm not a Jungian.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he was just being himself and doing what came naturally.
Right. Right,
you know, sprung from his unique personhood, and somehow figuring it all out, writing it down, putting it in books, and then trying to do the same thing, there's a big gap there. And that's a point that comes across really strongly in your writing, very effectively.
Yeah, and again, it's this, the way I wrote the book, it's not about a theory, it's not about a technique, because those all can work. But if we are so focused on implementing those and we're not paying attention to the individual, we totally rob ourselves and the individual of being able to transcend not just their problem, but to have a transformative experience. I remember the early days when I got into therapy and I would watch some of the old videos of I mean, it's kind of wild. You think back to some of the, remember the Gloria video with Fritz?
I taught for years, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's embarrassing to admit how many years I showed that video. Because it was all we had.
Yeah. And you watch all three of those guys. And, you know, we can
Carl debate. Rogers, Fritz Perls.
And Albert Ellis.
Yeah.
And we can debate who was the best and all that. And the stories behind that we'll put to the side. But all of them were just totally genuine, being who they were in the moment, and they weren't so hung up. No, follow my script. It just seemed to spring from them. Watching someone like Virginia Satir, yeah, she had an idea of how she wanted to work, but she was improvising most of the time, and it was beautiful. It was beautiful. Right. I mean, Carl Whitaker, watching and reading his stuff, that guy was just out there, and I don't want to tell people to just throw anything out at any time. That's where the good grounding in your theory and your technique, but not trying to force people or force ourselves into something that's not natural or not appropriate at that moment. You rob yourself of magic. You rob your client, your patient of magic.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the themes in your work is each person is unique.
Yes.
And therefore, you do them, we psychotherapists tend often to do them a disservice by laying some template on them that right. sort of blocks us being able to really see and respond to their uniqueness and meet them with our own uniqueness.
Right, Exactly. And that's, you know, going back to Dr. Erickson, he told, I can't remember who, that every client, every person is a unique as their thumbprint. And when we try to fit them in, you know, we rob them of their individuality. And he was one who every person he met had their own theory, had their own technique, because it was based on what they're giving. If I could leave anyone with what about how to do a therapy session, the big thing would be it's a co-creation. It's a co-creation. We think we are doing things to them. It's almost we're doing this observer who's watching things, and we're kind of up here direct. We're a part of the action. We are a part of the action until we admit that we are a part of the therapy. Our being is a part of the therapy. And if we want the client to change, you know, we may have to adjust things about ourselves. And then our adjustment causes an adjustment to them. And it becomes this dynamic flow of co-creating this thing we call, that we're using language to call, a psychotherapy session. And I think sometimes a lot of therapists, particularly who are in this linear cause and effect way of seeing things, get hung up. It's, I'm doing this to them. Now, they won't state that because it sounds terrible, but it is. I'm going to fix your behavior. I'm going to fix your cognition. I'm going to fix, I'm the, and it doesn't work like that.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things that we have in common is an interest in shamanism and the shamanic way of healing. And right. You write about that, and you write about when you first started to confront your sense that you weren't being as creative as you could be and as you wanted to be, that you began to look into and study shamanic practices. Tell us something about those days.
Yeah, sure. And it's still go on. I mean, I was the other day, I was doing some reading and interacting with someone who's a curandero, a Mexican shamanism, learning about things about that. But I want to make a big distinction. I'm not one of those people that says add shamanism to psychotherapy. And my definition of shamanism is the one that Iliade, who kind of coined the term back in the 40s, used. So for me, a psychotherapist is not a shaman according to that definition, because a shaman goes on vision quests, talks with the dead, all of that. I view the psychotherapist as healers. We are healers. And we have a wonderful tradition. It's a short tradition. But getting back to shamans, what I learned from most shamans is there's an element of performance.
Yeah.
And when they have their techniques, but it's also about the person. So when when two brains meet, it sounds like a neuroscience joke, two brains meet in a bar, but two brains meet, they interact off each other. I mean, we're going to talk about the mirror neurons and all of those kind of things. So if I am able to access parts of myself from a performance perspective, that alone can affect the state of the person I'm talking to. What I got from most people who were legitimate shamans, and I learned a lot from here. I live in South Carolina presently, and I learned a lot from what we call root doctors. And they're we call them hoodoo doctors, not voodoo, but hoodoo. It's like the African-American spiritual tradition that was brought over from Africa and then blended with Protestantism and those kind of things. But what I got from talking to these people is you're not really directly doing anything. You're creating, as I mentioned, these conditions for this magic to come. So the rituals, the any chants, the making the what they call the root, which we call a mojo if we're in New Orleans, little mojo bag. You know, all of that is part of a performance, if you will, that gets the person's mind out of an ordinary experience. So while I'm wrestling with trying to follow the book and be a linear cause and effect type thinker, I need to also, this is what it taught me, to embrace performance a little more, not a calculated performance, but being just so present. There's got to be power in what we're doing. And I don't mean a forceful power, an emotional power, because that's what activates our brain. If we aren't really feeling that deep connection. And number two, that something different's going on. Then we're just having a conversation. I can have a free conversation with any family member I want and get tons of free advice. What makes a therapist different? It's not our techniques and tools. That's what I got from the research, from the shamans and these root doctors. It's the performance aspect, shifting their consciousness away from something and setting a new context to create and see what is created. That's one of the big things I got.
What do you think? This is just an idea that pops up from what you were saying. You go to psychotherapy conferences, and the stars actually put on a performance. They'll get a volunteer. Fritz Perls was one of the originators of this back in the day, and get somebody up on the stage, and there is a, you know, they're not used to being on the stage, so it's definitely the client isn't, and so there is a big emotional setup there. That's going to make it very likely that something's going to happen. And you've got this weird old geezer there as being very provocative. And then having you talk to yourself, moving back and forth between two different chairs. So there are a lot of the elements there of that. Yeah. And sometimes I've wondered, or and it's probably not an original thought, but that those guys and women who perform at conferences, they've got a little bit of an edge. It may not always go that well when they're doing their private sessions. One has to wonder, you know, because they've got a real edge of expectation. It's different, all kinds of stuff going on.
Well, you know, Dave, you hit it exactly. Number one, expectation. I don't think we as therapists, set enough expectancy that healing's going to happen. Mm-hmm. We even talk sometimes to talk it down. You know, well, you know, change is going to come slow, or okay, you may feel a little better, but it's going to get worse before it gets better. I'm like, really? Is that what you want to tell somebody? I mean, is that absolutely true in every case? No. But you know, we have all these cliches that are other people's ideas. But if we start from day one setting the expectancy, and as public disclosure, as one of those people at the workshops who brings people up every now and then, sorry, I know very well there's some expectancy okay. there.
Yeah.
And I'm going to use it. I am going to use it, man.
Uh-huh.
And instead of saying, you know, we'll see how this goes, having the confidence, just to even say, look, I don't know if you're going to change in this area, but if you and I work together, there's going to be some kind of change somewhere. Now, think about that. Why wouldn't there be? Every time we meet somebody new, anytime we form a new relationship, we're changed by it. So maybe fostering this expectancy is part of the magic. When you go in there and you're 80% sold on something, I mean, it's so easy to be the therapist because the client's just in that state. You're in that state. But I think I read somewhere that we don't want to, you know, make sure get people's hopes up. And I said, no, they need hope. My God, they need hope. If they had hope, they wouldn't be with you. You know, if hope, they've lost hope. They can't give them hope. You have to give them the hope. That's why they've come.
Yeah,
I don't understand where some people think about these things, but yes, expectancy, hope, something's got to be different.
You know, if you go back into the history of hypnosis to Anton Mesmer, maybe he got carried away. I don't know, but some of the accounts say that he got into wearing a, you know, like a magician's kind of cap and purple flowing robes and had people behind the curtains. Playing violin music and so on. People were flocking to him because it was there was so much word of mouth, and he was a phenomenon, and people like, I think it was Mozart, the young Mozart was brought to him, and a lot of historically famous people.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this panel to decide whether or not it really was, there was such a thing as animal magnetism, and Benjamin Franklin, who was on that panel, concluded that, well, it was just suggestion, suggestion.
Yeah, just.
Just. But that's wonderful. What we know, based on, you know, what you're saying here, is that we need all those tools And yes, you want to have implicit suggestion that inspires hope and expectation that something's going to happen, a change is going to come.
Right. Yeah, it's another thing I got from studying the kind of the shamans and the root doctors was, in addition to performance, it's a set and setting. You know, how we decorate our offices, what we showcase, how we talk to people. Actually, the phrase used, I'll give you an example. I was talking to a guy one time who was a hoodoo doctor, and he specialized with treating people who had physical as well as some emotional stuff. And by the way, it's very difficult to get a lot of these people to talk to me. So when I did get to talk to somebody, I was very blessed because it was kind of a hidden tradition. But we're talking about something, and then all of a sudden, he changes his tone, and he looks right at me, and he says, Dr. Leslie, I've got something to tell you. I know that you think you've come here to ask me these questions, but I'm going to tell you something right now, and you better listen. There's a bigger reason why you've come to tell me. I've come to tell you something. The people up there want you to know something. If you'll pay attention, you're about to learn something right now. Now, the reason I'm saying that
kind
way,
of galvanized you, I'm sure. Yeah, right.
I don't even remember what the heck he said, but it's like I was in a trance, so to speak.
Yes.
But why not talk? I mean, maybe not that way, but talk to our clients with passion, with certainly with respect. But it all comes from us, and we're if we're thinking that we use the technique and the theory, that's great. We're using that, but it's got to come from us. We have to have that behavioral flexibility to be charismatic, if I can use that term, or what I prefer, having a healing presence. If we don't have a healing presence and we don't have that alliance, your technique ain't going to work.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you rail quite a bit, and I would agree with this, against traditional graduate training, and that a lot of that sort of is a turns us off of whatever natural healing thing we might have had. When I decided to go into clinical psychology, I think there was a feeling, I've had the feeling from high school and so on, that people liked to talk to me and that they would share their issues and that we would bond around that stuff. And so I thought, becoming a psychologist might be something about that, about getting down to the brass tacks of what it is to be a human being and sharing that stuff. And it wasn't that at all. And it wasn't until I got involved in what was going on at the time as the encounter group movement, where you get in a circle of more or less peers and give each other feedback. And people started reflecting back to me who I was in a positive way, that I felt reinforced for who I was.
Right.
But there was, in the coursework that I did, there was really no focus on my person and no encouragement to kind of come out as the person that I am.
Yeah. I think that's still prevalent. I'm also, just as an aside, I'm very disappointed by not, and I'm not trying not to overgeneralize, but a lot of graduate programs, it's very little attention to our forefathers and mothers in the field. I don't feel like we have enough grounding in the people who came before us and who seem to have certain skills, talents, the way they're being. And I think we probably need to investigate those. But, and I get it. We have this fear that, you know, the student's going to say or do something wrong. Unfortunately, counseling, psychotherapy, whatever you want to call it, has been lumped into the medical aspect of things. And it's a little different than, I don't really have a lot of experience, but I do think I can remove a gallbladder. You know, we really need you to do all this stuff. So I need to put my humanity to the side if I'm a counselor and make sure I'm following all these kind of things. And then if I'm lucky, I'll remember to bring it back when I've had enough experience. I don't have an answer for this, but I'm hoping there's a way you can have, instead of either or, both, a program that teaches people how to bring who they are to it. But yet things like you know, you ever thought about not talking and let your client talk? And, you know, there's a point where self-disclosure is too much. You know, all those things that we need to know. Yeah. You notice you're not doing the technique right. It could probably be more effective. You notice the word open-ended, close-ended questions. But instead of just having, we're only going to focus on that to where you're a blank slate. I think that's held over from the Freudian thing, too, it being a blank slate, not showing things. There's got to be some kind of balance. And I'm hoping, and I know there's some programs out there. I know a couple of colleagues of mine, if they're listening, they'll be like, what are you talking about? I do that. I know you do if you're listening. But a lot of them, unfortunately, they don't.
Yeah, yeah. There's a real tension, I think, that you're dealing with and trying to get the message across that you're getting across, which is there's so much emphasis these days on evidence-based, and that's something you kind of talk about. What we do has to be evidence-based. And it's not like you're completely against that. You're struggling with the tension because your book is loaded with references.
Yes.
You've got lots and lots of references about studies that give you an evidence-based support for the very position that you're arguing for.
Right.
And so it's a weird, it's almost paradoxical place that you're in, that you're doing a balancing act in your writing.
Yeah, my totem animal is I'm told is the moose, and the moose is known for paradox and having holding two things at once. So that's a lot of how I see the world too. When I say evidence-based, my first question is, well, who's evidence? And there's all these studies, but again, there's also even tons of studies on that all the major therapies and techniques work equal. When they take out everything else, they work equally well. So when you hear too much about evidence-based, my issue with that is that somebody trying to sell a training program or to get funding sometimes. Because Carl Rogers, I think, had a lot of evidence. I remember reading a lot of his stuff, and people have not. So he's no longer in because I don't guess there's enough evidence because they've done studies to show, oh, this is better than person-centered. Or, but when you really tear down those studies and find out, that they're all good. They're all, and I'm not talking about, you know, crazy stuff like rebirthing and those kind of, you know, pseudo crazy stuff. I'm talking about the major ideas and research. So rather than limit ourselves and stick to this term, it's only evidence based. Yes, we need that, but we also need to be an artist in addition to being a scientist. I think a good psychotherapist is both. If you're not an artist and a scientist, you're not a painter of words and a researcher. You're missing the boat. Some people, again, it's this either or. I say here, both.
You know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a paradox.
Yeah. You know, you talk about the dodo bird effect in that context, and the decline of therapy and therapy incomes. But take us through that piece of it a bit here.
And a lot of this is based on, I want to mention the work, if people are interested in this, there's a lot of work on the common factors. I'm just going to briefly mention some names and forget some names, so I hope nobody's upset. Bruce Wampold, Mark Hubble, Scott Miller, Barry Duncan, Michael Lambert, John Norcross. I'm just missing some people. But that's your first go-to in that you're looking at you know, where those, what are those common factors that really do make a change? About the incomes, that was based off some research I think Scott Miller and Mark Hubble did, or had at least had given to me. And it was about how graduate school prices continue to rise. Incomes, according to the APA, is continuing to either not rise or actually fall. And for a field that should be as robust and dynamic, we have to wonder what's going on. What's also going on is the cost of training programs continues to go up. Everyone who has a new training program, I was at a conference in December, the Brief Therapy Conference in San Francisco, and we had a running joke, a couple of us, you just pick random therapy things and put them together and you have a new therapy. So I could say, I teach experiential, cognitive, developmental, biofeedback, mindfulness therapy. And then you trademark it and you charge $3,000 a level for it. So we have the training programs going up in cost, graduate school going up in cost. Our salaries are going down. And there's an article last year in the Psychotherapy Networker by Hubble and Miller who talked about how the big booming business in comparison are psychic mediums. Their incomes are going through the roof. And here's the thing. They get results. People are happy with them. Whether or not we want to believe in them, people feel like they're getting emotional benefit from it. So
that goes back to the shamanic. That's the shamanic tradition again.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Yeah. And our numbers are going down.
Yeah.
I got a doctoral degree. I'm trying to get out of student loan debt. Don't tell me this.
Right.
Yeah. But I think that's it because they don't, they view that, you know, psychotherapy can have benefit, but I think people want an experience of wonder. And if they can get an experience of wonder and connection, and they don't have to go through a medical model, you know, psychotherapeutic jargon stuff, I think most people will do that.
Yeah, well, I think of the rise of coaching, which has freed even people who have credentials as psychotherapists. Some people with PhDs find a lot more freedom describing themselves as a coach, and also less stigma. That people have a sort of stigmatized version of view of psychotherapy, psychology, psychologists, etc. Mm-hmm. And I'm a coach. I'm just going to talk, you know, you're not going to have to talk about your past and a bunch of stuff like that. We're just going to focus on how to make you more successful.
Right. Yeah. And I get it. And stigma is one of the things that is the biggest drawback. And research has shown that the images we get, which have gotten a little better in the last few years, but historically over 40 years, Hollywood has not been very kind to psychotherapy. I can say that with some authority because that's what my dissertation was on about the perceptions and media and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And it's just overall been negative. There's some bright lights recently, but it gets in the back of their mind. And it's like, I don't want to go in. And I teach sometimes when I teach introductory psychology at the college I work, I get the perception that everyone's going to go sit and lie on a couch. And they're going to relently ask you about, you know, your sex life and your mother and all those kind of things. But let's be blunt. Who does that anymore? Even psychodynamic therapists don't off the bat charge in, at least good ones, and you know, start doing that. But it's those media perceptions. Whereas if I can turn on Long Island Medium. I think I saw that show one time where it's got the lady from Long Island who's a psychic medium, and people who are struggling with grief sit down and talk about, you know, they miss their dad, and the dad shows up in the session and says he loves you, he's proud of you, and their heart is open and they feel good and they're done. They feel great. I feel validated and connected.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about you, but if I had to talk to Fraser Crane or the Long Island Medium, if I didn't know any better, I'd probably talk to the Long Island Medium. You know? But I love Fraser too, but you know.
Yeah. You know, you're talking about media depictions of psychologists, psychotherapists. For me, the standout best one was Robin Williams. I don't know. But
Goodwill Hunting?
Yeah, Goodwill Hunting. I thought that was just a wonderful depiction of a therapist.
It was. And I remember I was teaching a class and I showed clips from the movie and we had to talk about, is this ethical or not? And, you know, those kind of things. Because I remember in one of those scenes where the Matt Damon character finds out that Robin Williams' wife died. And it's still, you know, he's still in Williams' character's in grief. And he keeps saying these negative things to get the therapist goad. And then Robin Williams jacks him up by the throat and says, if you mention one more thing about my wife, I'll end you. But then
it's been a long time since I saw the movie. So that was kind of a global perception that I had.
That was in the movie. That was the thing that changed that started a dialogue between them. So that film, since you brought it up, use that film. Is that ethical? Well, obviously it's not ethical to grab somebody by the throat. Yeah. But let me say this. The experience of interacting with that person being so radically different, surprising, improvisational in that moment, changed the relationship. So, again, kids listening at home, don't grab people by the throat. But do something different, because that's what, you know, creates that connection. That's what creates some. It's like if you're doing the same thing over and over again, it's like nature. Nature has to have something random to change its patterns.
Yeah.
So that's what I pulled back when you said that movie. That's the scene I thought of. And it was so, we weren't expecting it, but that caused a shift in the interaction.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I pulled out something out of each of the chapters of your book, of the magic book, that I was going to step us through, but I shifted gears here and just thought, no, I can't do that. We've got to be present with each other here, and hopefully that's been your experience. And
absolutely.
So as we begin to wind down here, I'm just wondering if there's kind of, I really think you've got your message through in this conversation, but if there's any kind of wrap-up thing. You know, the book is really directed to psychotherapists and to inspire them, and both books. It doesn't mean that lay people that are watching this or listening to this couldn't benefit from it as well. Mm-hmm. But you're really trying to empower psychotherapists, I think. Any kind of closing words that you'd like to say here?
Well, if I could tell, if somebody said, give me some advice, and I would tell them, trust yourself. We all know down deep, particularly if we are called to be healers, and by call, I mean an inner calling, that if we can get past our own ego or our own desire to fit into the mold of somebody else or some other idea, we know what we need to say a lot of times, what we need to do, and allow our intuition to guide us. And I think if we learn to just trust ourselves and be open to whatever could happen in the moment, so much healing can happen when you just give your client a space to be who they are, but you make a space for who you are too. And I think that's probably the most important thing. I think I have learned to be more flexible and to be more human by doing therapy and realizing the times that I wanted to be too directive or in charge, all that. I was taking on a persona that wasn't me. I can be directive and still be me. I can be indirect and still be me. So I would just say, open yourself up to wondrous things. Take calculated chances and be in the moment, be spontaneous, be creative, and trust yourself.
Well, that's a great message for us all to take to heart. And Dr. Paul Blocken, but Dr. Paul J. Leslie, see, I was into so much of your trance, on your name. Thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. Great.
It's my pleasure. It's been an honor, and you do great work, Dave, and thank you.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Paul J. Leslie. It's clear that we have a lot in common, especially in terms of our admiration for the work of Milton Erickson and his followers. And now I have to add Dr. Leslie to those interpreters of Erickson's work that I admire as having made a significant contribution to the Ericksonian literature. Sadly, neither of us were able to actually meet Erickson. However, I'm impressed by the diligence that Paul has demonstrated in these two books we discussed, to the point that if I were still in practice, I'd want to visit him and perhaps receive supervision from him to make my sessions, quotes, magical. In the interview, he comes across as a fairly mild-mannered fellow, but when he shifted into demonstrating the manner of the Gula healer that he interviewed, he really transformed into that very forceful and charismatic personality. It was powerful enough that it kind of set me back on my heels, so to speak. It really made the point he was making about the value of shifting into an authoritative, charismatic stance when called for. I encourage you to find the place in the YouTube version of the interview so that you can really experience it with him looking at you as he's looking into the camera and I experienced him looking at me. I highly recommend both books to all you therapists, counselors, life coaches, and healers of whatever stripe. He has a wealth of personal examples from his own work. You heard a few in the interview. He offers some quick snapshots of his own magical interventions in the introduction to the second book, The Art of Creating a Magical Session, Key Elements for Transformative Psychotherapy. He writes, memorable cases that became magical included a father and son who had been estranged for years, finally making an emotional connection when they were instructed to talk to each other as if they were professional wrestlers. I love that. He goes on to say, a woman was finally able to let go of her painful past when all the furniture in the therapy room had been turned upside down. Another one, a mother who saw herself as a doormat made significant changes after a large rug was thrown onto her lap. Here's another one. A self-professed kleptomaniac changed her behavior after being given permission and free rein to steal anything in the therapy office. And finally, a client experienced a tremendous shift in how she viewed herself after a poem had been read to her. Close quote. Beyond those sorts of stories and suggestions as to how the reader might best summon up the creativity to create this sort of liveliness in their own practices, the book is full of thought-provoking commentary about professional issues. While he's critical on the one hand about the rigidity of many graduate training programs, on the other hand, he's adamant about the value of training, historical perspective, and so on. He insists that these sorts of magical interventions can be woven into just about any theoretical perspective. He walks a fine line between criticizing theory and technique without criticizing any particular theoretical perspective. In fact, after having read these two books, I can't even tell you what his overall theoretical orientation is. My guess would be some version of eclectic. I share his conviction that rational science has a role to play in evaluating the claims of various psychotherapies, but rationality isn't the whole story. We mustn't forget our roots and our history as practitioners of healing. And moreover, that we're not so much the healers as the facilitators of our clients' self-healing.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for a while, so I thought it was high time for me to make a donation, for a couple of reasons. First of all, you've pointed me in the direction of some very interesting authors, whose books I have bought and obviously paid for, so I figured it was only fair that you get a reward for your own work. And secondly, these long, in-depth interviews are sort of a niche format, produced almost exclusively by independent podcasters who rely on individual donations to cover their own costs. So I'd like to appeal to all your listeners to step up to the plate and make a donation. Thank you very much for all your good work.
Thank you, Michael Ginter, for your very well-reasoned rationale for becoming a financial donor. I hope others will also be persuaded by your reasoning. In the past month, we've gained two new donors. My thanks go out to Lisa Bowers and Al Goonan. Unfortunately, there are no new transcripts to announce. I'm missing Pat Bautista already. Let me remind you that there is a Shrink Wrap Radio app in the iTunes App Store. There is a one-time cost of $2.99, of which I get a whopping $1, and I get to pay $30 a month so that I can offer it to you. It's a really good deal for you, though, because it puts 400-plus of my most recent episodes in your pocket or purse, and works with either the iPhone or Android phones. For full details, check out the Apps tab at shrinkwrapradio.com. And by the way, I should rush to tell you that you don't have to worry about those 400 episodes clogging up the memory on your phone, because they stream to your phone, so the app takes up very little memory. And it does give you the option, though, of downloading episodes to your phone. So, for example, if you're traveling, if you're going to be on an airplane, and you'd like to listen to one or more episodes. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Paul J. Leslie, for teaching us about the conditions that lead to magical, transformative therapy sessions. Next week, I'll be speaking with Jungian analyst Renee Cunningham about archetypal nonviolence. This should be a fascinating topic. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.